so-called high sensitivity troponin in heart attack assessment.
Do patients with Medicare Advantage plans have lower hospital readmission rates?
What is the significance of adrenal incidentalomas?
And changing antiplatelet therapy after heart stents?
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed Double T, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a medical journalist at Johns Hopkins, and this will be posted on June 28, 2019.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, I'd like to turn first to the New England Journal of Medicine. I said this high sensitivity troponin assessment in suspected heart attack or myocardial infarction. We've been talking about this for years. And in fact, standard of care right now, it really involves this particular test when someone comes to the ED. In this case, they took a look at almost 23,000 patients. They said, okay, high sensitivity troponin 1 concentrations of less than 6 nanograms per liter, absolute change, and a lot of other metrics in a certain time period. They resulted in a negative predictive value of 99.5%. Pretty good. But the question is, can we include a bunch of other assessments, time period, change, to see how predictive is this thing ultimately? So they tried to develop a tool that integrated both the high sensitivity troponin concentration in the ED, the change during several samples, the time between the obtaining of the samples, and say, hey, what's the probability of the outcome of myocardial infarction and 30-day outcomes? At the end of the day, it was really, yeah, maybe we can use this. And I'm wondering how this much more complicated algorithm is going to be manifest.
People have a heart attack and those heart muscle cells die. They leak this protein, troponin, into the blood. If it leaks just a little bit, you need high sensitivity assays or tests to determine whether it's there or not. And then what happens is it rises over time if there's been a true heart attack. What you'd like to be able to do is take those individuals that have chest pain and haven't had a heart attack and let them be able to go home. What these authors did was using high sensitivity troponin, the range of it and how it acts over the first several hours after somebody presents, be able to predict with 99.5% assurance that the person did not have a heart attack and send them home safely. And that's the virtue of this.
Yeah, I get it. I'm just wondering about the complexity of this algorithm. And certainly for those people in that intermediate risk group, because clearly those at either end are fairly easily identifiable, need to be further delineated. It's just that this seems like a kind of complicated thing to do.
We have computers. So if you just plug in the values, the computer will tell you what the assessment is. So it may seem complicated on paper, but with the tools we have now, it's really not very complicated at all.
And so are you suggesting that this is going to become the new standard of care?
I think it certainly could be. It's got a very good negative predictive value. That's really what you want to know. Who can you send home safely?
Since we're talking about the heart, why don't we turn to the Journal of the American Medical Association, so-called dual antiplatelet therapy, and what do we need to do there?
Dual antiplatelet therapy is the use of aspirin plus another antiplatelet agent, one that's usually called a P2Y12 inhibitor, in people that have stents placed in their arteries in their heart. Because once that metal stent is placed, whether it's coated with a drug or not, there's a risk of a clot forming on that in the first several weeks and months after it's been placed, and the person can subsequently have a heart attack, can die. Individuals get dual antiplatelet therapy to prevent that. How long does that need to continue? Because individuals that receive it are at an increased risk of bleeding. So typically, it's been recommended that individuals receive it for at least 1 year. Well, there are two studies back-to-back in the Journal of the American Medical Association that suggest that the dual antiplatelet therapy can administer for a shorter period of time and just a single antiplatelet agent carried farther. Half the individuals received dual antiplatelet therapy for the year. The other received dual antiplatelet therapy for either 1 month or 3 months, and then switched to just the P2Y12 inhibitor. And what they discovered was the incidence of cardiovascular events after that was really not significantly different between the groups. Actually, it was a little bit lower in the individuals in one study that received the short dual antiplatelet therapy. But what it did do was it decreased the risk of bleeding. Does this mean everybody should stop their dual antiplatelet therapy soon after the stent was placed, within 1 or 3 months? No, these were relatively low-risk patients, and higher-risk patients probably need to have it continued for a year. This needs to be verified in larger studies, because in the world of cardiology, when the event rates are so low, about 2%, we need to have not 3,000 patients, we need to have 20 or 30,000 patients to confirm these results.
Is it your suspicion that they'll be confirmed? And what do you perceive as the advantages to patients in being able to discontinue dual antiplatelet therapy earlier?
Most important is to decrease the risk of bleeding. And the other is there's a cost as well. In these studies, the antiplatelet agent that was stopped after 1 to 3 months was aspirin. And that's usually just pennies.
Let's turn to Annals of Internal Medicine. I think this is the first time I've actually ever seen incidentaloma written out in a scientific paper. Certainly heard it plenty of times. What the authors were looking at were adrenal incidentalomas, found, of course, when people are having studies for other reasons. And they divided them into two groups, non-functioning adrenal tumors or adenomas that caused mild autonomous cortisol excess. This is a meta-analysis comprising 32 studies with outcomes of over 4,000 patients with either of these two types of tumors, the majority of whom were women. They said, well, what's significant about this? So the mean tumor growth was 2 millimeters over almost 53 months of follow-up. They saw a little bit of tumor enlargement occurring in just over 2% of the patients, and none of them developed adrenal cancer over the follow-up period. Interestingly, though, hypertension, obesity, dyslipidemia, type 2 diabetes were highly prevalent and were more likely to develop and worsen in those patients who had the tumors that caused the mild autonomous cortisol excess. New cardiovascular events were more prevalent in those folks than in the ones who had the non-functioning adrenal tumors. And so that may be the most important thing about this study was there is a relationship between these tumors and these cardiovascular conditions.
This ends up being important because when people have a routine scan of their abdomen, whether it was the CT or MRI, about 4 or 5% of individuals are found to have these incidental tumors in their adrenals, and there's really been uncertainty about how do you address that. This study addresses that. As you mentioned, they don't become malignant, they may grow a little bit, and they don't develop Cushing's disease, but there can be a mild excess of cortisol secretion, a steroid, in some individuals. It's associated with cardiovascular risk, that is hypertension, obesity, dyslipidemia, type 2 diabetes, but it doesn't cause an increase in mortality compared to the adrenal tumors that don't secrete cortisol. So I've always wondered what to do with these because you say, well, you need to keep subjecting the patient to repeated scans to see what happens or completed blood tests. But what this suggests is you really don't need to be doing that.
So that's good news.
Yeah, I mean, this is really good. And again, it's the first time we've reported on incidentalomas.
Let's turn to our final one, also in Annals of Internal Medicine, looking at Medicare Advantage and how that impacts on hospital readmissions.
This is kind of a broader topic about the quality of care in Medicare Advantage plans versus traditional Medicare programs. This is important because the federal government is really trying to push people on Medicare from the traditional Medicare programs. That's where there's a fee for service, where the physicians and hospitals get paid for whatever work they do, into what's called a Medicare Advantage program. What happens under Medicare Advantage is CMS pays private health plans a monthly capitated payment for each patient. And it allows the plans to determine who their provider is, whether they provide special programs to try to keep the patient healthy, and hopefully to prevent hospital readmissions as well. And by the way, if there's any money left over at the end of it, the plans get to keep the money. So you would think that the plans would be driven towards improved quality of care. Now, the flip side is maybe they restrict care, and that's the way they save money. So what these authors did was they examined one of the measures of quality of care, that is hospital readmission rates. Because as you know, there's been a big push over the last 5 to 6 years to decrease hospital readmission rates. So they looked at patients over the age of 65 at almost 5,000 acute care hospitals that were hospitalized for either acute heart attacks, congestive heart failure, or pneumonia. And they looked at the readmission rate between patients in the traditional Medicare program versus those in the Medicare Advantage. And what they found out was, after adjusting for the risk of the patients, is the patients in the Medicare Advantage programs didn't have a lower readmission rate, they had a slightly higher readmission rate. And by the way, over the last 4 to 5 years, that gap has continued to increase. Now, it was relatively modest. It was a 0.5 to 0.6 absolute percentage increase in readmission rate. But because of the large number of patients, that ends up being huge numbers. For example, those differences translate to an excess of approximately 2,700 readmissions for a heart attack, 6,000 readmissions for congestive heart failure, and 12,000 readmissions for pneumonia for patients in the Medicare Advantage program versus traditional Medicare.
Okay. And so if you were the king of the forest, what would you do to address this?
Well, since we're pushing more and more patients to Medicare Advantage, right now it's sitting around 30%. It's going to increase to 40 or 45%. I think we really need to address that. If we're really trying to drive the cost of care down while still maintaining quality of care, we need to examine what's going on here. The program's not working properly. Are individuals not receiving the care they need during the hospitalization that's causing them to be readmitted? Or are there some unknown patient characteristics that we can identify? Because again, if we cut the cost of care, that is, we've capitated it, and people are getting readmitted, that's not increased quality of care.
But you wouldn't speculate right now on what you think the reasons are.
No, unfortunately, this study is very clear, is they don't provide the reason. What they do say is that previous studies have suggested that the Medicare Advantage programs had lower hospital readmissions, but the data they had weren't very complete. So this is the most complete data that we have. And what they report is that many of the Medicare Advantage programs underreport their hospital readmission rates. So they said if you look at it honestly, as completely as possible, and risk adjust the patients, there is no benefit in terms of hospital readmissions. It's actually higher. Now we need to figure out why that is.
On that note, that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up and make healthy choices.